Okay. Let me see if the mic is on. Okay, now it's on. That's good. Okay, so we're talking last week, and I made a statement that a quote from the rabbis, and that is that the Torah, or God says, it's not clear from the Gemara itself. Well, let's take it being the Torah, being the Torah is personified and says that if you leave me for one day, I'll leave you for 2 days. So if you remember, we were discussing that, right? Okay, so what I was saying is that there's going to be a loss in terms of the relationship the person has with his learning, and if he abandons it one day, you'd think it'd only be 1 day's loss, but really the Torah is telling you it's more. There's more of an impact, and that's what it means. The Torah says, I'll abandon you for 2 days, meaning it'll take that much longer for you to get back into you. It won't be able to get back into it right away. If you leave me for 1 day, you can't just jump right back into your studies. And evidently, what that means is that there's a certain relationship that a person has with wisdom. And if he's preoccupied with other pursuits, so then that takes his energy away from the wisdom and the whole pattern of thinking and even the emotional attachment to it, you know, many aspects of it. So to re-engage it is difficult. And it's not simply a mechanical thing. Instead of the wafer for a day, I can get right back into it. No, it has an effect. It changes the person's mode, because when he was in it, then he was engaged in thinking, so then things are readily on his mind, readily at his fingertips. But he leaves it, so the energy is withdrawn, and he doesn't have all those inroads like he had readily at his fingertips when he was in the moment of study. So you could realize that from studies in school, that when you had crammed for a test, so the day before the test everything was really clear in your mind. Two days later, your mind basically did a mind dump, where the test was over. There was no reason to be attached to it anymore, and it was much more difficult to recollect everything that you had after during the time prior to the test. So Doug brought the point that he wanted to take issue with that, whether that's true or not. And it ended up that the Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, actually has both of our opinions, which really made sense after I looked at it. And what it said was, and I sent it out to the group during the week, and it gave me two analogies to this phenomenon. One analogy is that you have two people, two different parts of Israel. One's in Tiberias, one is in the Sepphoris. And they start traveling, and they end up meeting at an inn, and then they continue their travels, and it won't be that long that in a mile's journey they end up to be 2 miles apart, because if one guy is traveling to the east and one guy is traveling to the west, right, and then they end up meeting in that inn, that means they were traveling towards each other. And they keep on their paths. Now they're going to go in opposite directions. And in the, let's say, an hour's journey, you can go an hour. Let's say it's a half an hour. You can get a mile, whatever. They'll end up being 2 miles apart. So that's supposed to be the analogy to the abandonment of wisdom. If you're not involved in wisdom, so it's not that you only walked a mile in one direction. Wisdom also walked the other way, a mile, so to speak. So it ended up, in the course of time that it took for you to walk 1 mile, you're really 2 miles away from wisdom. Okay, so you see that analogy, right?
Excellent.
Okay, so what that means is that there's basically a mechanical type of there's a result, just in terms of the very fact that there's a distance from it. And what's important to note here is that in this case, the two men didn't know each other from the beginning. Why does it have to tell us about the beginning, where they started from? And really, the Talmud should have just stated that there were two men in the inn, and they walked away from each other, and then in 1 mile's distance, they were really 2 miles apart. That's all we really need to know, because our whole topic is that you're engaged in study, and then when you leave it, so it's like you're walking this way a mile, and Torah is walking the other way for a mile. So So the question I have is that what does the Talmud have to start off with the fact that there were two men? One was in this town, the other one was in that town, and then they start walking towards each other. That seems to be extraneous to our topic. You see my question? That doesn't seem to be needed. We only need it from the point that they met. So why is it? Why does the Talmud include that additional information in the analogy? Let me just see if, if you have the, you have my question or no?
Yes, Rabbi.
Yeah, I have it.
Okay. So I think the need to bring that in is to show you that the relationship was that it was really a casual relationship that these two people had. They didn't really know each other from beforehand. That's what it means, that they started from two different places. They weren't in the same town, meaning that the relationship that Jack had with Joe was just because they encountered each other at the inn. Prior to that, they didn't know each other. They were two different cities, far apart. So that's one type of description that the Talmud has given you on the relationship. Sometimes you have a relationship with your studies which is very casual. So if that's the case, if it's just a brief encounter, you open a book, you read something, and then you continue back on your path of life, whatever your involvement is, so then you're going to be distancing yourself, not one day's journey, but 2 days' journey away from your wisdom. Because your whole relationship to it is not a chosen, preferred relationship. There are other things that occupy time, and it's a mere brief encounter. So that's the first analogy that Talmud gives. The second analogy, it says there's a woman who's waiting for this man, and as long as he keeps her in his thoughts, so she will wait for him. But once she hears that he's no longer thinking of her, she abandons him and she engages somebody else. See, here is where I believe it is addressing Doug's point, and that is that sometimes your relationship to learning is intimate, like a person who's engaged to a woman. If that's the case, so it doesn't matter that they're apart, because you see, the Talmud is telling you that she waits for him. If she's waiting for him, that means that they're not together. But the fact is that she is going to wait, meaning the Torah. She's an analogy to the Torah. So the Torah is going to wait for the person, and it'll always be there, and he could jump right back into the studies if his relationship to his Torah is like a betrothed fiancé. So then, as long as she is in his thoughts, it's there and it's ready for him to go back at any time. So then there isn't that loss. There isn't that two-day journey. Because that relationship is one where the person is in the back of his mind, because sometimes work is going to take you on a couple of days' journey. And you won't be able to really engage in wisdom. That happens. It happens to everybody. But if your attachment to study is one like a guy who can't stop thinking about his fiance. So if that's the person's relationship to his learning, so then the moment the work is over, he can go right back into it. The moment he can jump right back in, pick up right where he left off, because it's really in the back of his mind all the time. He's never really lost his attachment to it. So it was really nice to see that the Talmud bears out both of the opinions that Doug and I were discussing last week. All right, so I sent that to everybody. Everybody got both the text of the Talmud, and also I gave like a few paragraph explanation, right?
Yes, very good. Thank you. That was so helpful.
Yeah.
This explanation now is just making it like a spotlight is on it.
Mm-hmm. Good, good. Yeah, it was really nice to see. But you see, the details of the story are not just accidental. The rabbis, when they formulate an allegory, an analogy, a metaphor, all the components have a purpose. But like Maimonides says, sometimes it's just to paint the background, but sometimes each element in the metaphor has meaning. But other times it could be, you have a lot of verses that are really just giving you context. So you don't have to analyze every single word or every single verse. And if you do, it'll just hurt yourself. That's what Maimonides says. So you have to have the intelligence to know when to look at the detail and when not. But I think here clearly you need to, you see the details is necessary. Okay. All right, so let's go back. I'm going to finish up chapter 10 today in Kohelet. So two verses we're going to take up. Okay, so the verses we're in Unless there's any questions on this right now, before we go further, before we go back to Cahillis.
No, I don't have.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
If we want to, if we actually have the 2 miles difference, so to speak, double the space. In other words, if we turn away from Hashem for 1 day, it's like really he'll turn away for 2 days, because if we are at the fork of the road and we go one way, and Hashem is saying, okay, you don't want me, I don't want you, so we go the other way. He goes the other way. Well, he's traveling, and we're traveling. We're actually 2 miles. It adds up to the 2 miles. One from him, and one from us. And that would be with any situation that we get, in any kind of decision-making. The minute we walk away, the other person is walking away, so it doubles.
Well, we're talking about wisdom. Here it's talking about, I don't know if we can, apply this to other cases. This is specifically about wisdom.
Okay.
So I don't know.
I gather what it is. It's just that I was trying to make an analogy, and mine wasn't as clear as the way you had presented it. But I understand it. Thank you.
Okay.
I understand it.
All right. All right. All right. So we're back. And it's not. And it's also not God saying that I'm going to retaliate. It's describing the natural way that the human mind and the soul works. So there's not. God is not doing something here. You know, in terms of being vindictive or retaliating. It's describing how it works. This is the mechanics. The rabbis are telling us about how the mind works in terms of our different ways that the different behaviors of the mind in the two different types of relationships that a person has with wisdom. Okay. All right, so in Cahillis chapter 10, I'm going to do verses 19 and 20. Okay. So the verses go as follows. So for gladness, people make feasts of bread, and wine gladdens life, and money answers everything. Or with money, you will be able to address both your needs for bread and your needs for wine. Okay, so again, these verses on the surface, they seem like, what is it doing here? We're talking about, cities that have a king that's a good king or a poor king, and happy is the city, the land that is king is free from any type of emotional urges, where he controls himself and his officers also, they eat with might and not with drunkenness. And we said that he goes on in 18, and he gives a analogy which is clear to a person, that maybe if they're not, brushing shoulders with people in office, so we suggested that 18 is to bring it home, this lesson to bring it home to a regular person. And that is where he says that with laziness, the roof is going to sag, and with the laxity of the hands, meaning if a person doesn't work, so then the house will start, the rain will start coming in. It'll start dripping in. And that was really to bring home the point about how if your officers, if your people in government are really just self-serving, so then it's going to be akin to a house where the roof starts to sag and then it starts dripping, so the government to fall apart if people really aren't doing their duty. Okay. But it could also be that he's trying to show you how it applies not just to government, but it's not merely an analogy to government to make it easier for us to grasp. But what King Solomon is saying is that this applies equally to a person in his basic needs, the home. So he's trying to express that there's a need for diligence. And there's two parts to that. That's if you see that the roofs, if you don't tend to your house and you're just lazy, So then the roof is eventually going to sag. That's just nature. Things get wore out over time, and because of it gets weather beaten. And if you don't respond to that, so then the next thing is going to happen is that it's going to collapse, and you're going to have rain coming in, and so on. So he's showing you that you have to be proactive. You have to seek out where you see the problem starting. And then when the problem, if you don't, if the problem gets really severe, then certainly you have to address it. Now, because of that phenomenon, because of that personality that exists, he goes on, and perhaps now, this is why he tells you about food, about bread, and about wine, and about money. Because perhaps, why is a person lazy? Why doesn't the person tend to his house? You tell me.
Either they find other important things that they feel is important to do, or they find that it's going to take care of itself. I don't have to do it. It's like a laziness.
Well, I don't think the person will think it's going to take care of itself. A rational person knows that things break, they don't repair themselves.
So they don't put importance on it.
Right. Now the question is, why not? A person has...
I think maybe they're not thinking clearly. They're placing importance on other things that are not important. In other words, their value system is not very well put together. They're putting value on other things.
Yeah, okay.
So taking care of their house. Either taking care of
the
house...
What are the other things? What are the other things?
Going out for a good time. Okay. I don't have to clean the house, but I'd rather go to the movies.
Okay, good.
But they have work to do. They have work. They're placing the importance on the work because the work is their livelihood.
Well, they wouldn't do that because if the person has a good work ethic, he knows he has to have a house to live in order to work. But I would agree with what you said before that the person,
yeah,
a person is going to... and Nachshon, who's online, is saying that because people believe that Hashem will take care of the details. That's not the way to live, though. A person can't rely on miracles. The Torah is against that. We don't rely on God to take care of things that, you know, we can do ourselves. So we don't sit down at a table and the food's at the other end and just say, well, you know, God will slide the plate over to me so I can eat. That's a foolish type of thing. So, but I think it's like this, that why he brings in bread and wine is because he's really showing you that what's going to take the person, what's going to derail a person from those type of responsibilities is the labor's involved. They really wants to have a good time. So what King Solomon says, oh, you want to have a good time? Well, to have a good time, that means to have a good meal, to have bread and to have wine. If that's what you really want, you need money. And that he's trying to show you, see, that's the best argument, is when you use the person's very own position against them. So the person has a position that I'm not going to work and I'm not going to do this because, you know, I just want to have it easier. Well, if you want to have it easier, you want to have your food and this and that. Well, that takes money. And to have money, you're going to have a house that you can live in to come home to so you can sleep and you can work the next day. So that's what I believe he's doing. That's why this comes in next, is because he's answering up the very emotion that will cause a person to have the house collapse if he doesn't pay attention to it. Evidently, there's other things that he thinks he should be putting his time into. All right, so I believe that's why he says that about wine and bread, and because that's really where the person is coming from. All right? Okay, Nachshon, I see what you're saying. You say you agree. I was just saying that it's a prevalent belief. Yes, it is. It is prevalent. People are rely too much on God. A person has to do their part. They have to work diligently. The person does that, so then if he's living properly, yes, then the Torah has guarantees that God will help out. The things that a person can do themselves, they must do. They have to follow natural law. That's why natural law exists. God shows you there's repeating patterns. And he wants you to know that in order that you could work with it. That's the very point.
Rabbi, could I raise a question?
Yeah.
In Ecclesiastes, we read. At the end, the very end, it says futile, always futile. The main thing is to honor God and to do the mitzvahs and to honor Him and know that He is the one. In so many words, it did say it that way, but so I could read it if you want, but in so many words, it means all is futile. The main thing is to know there's a God.
And to do His mitzvahs, it says. Because this is all of man. Right.
Okay. So, if we do the mitzvahs, if we go in the way of Hashem, if we go in the way of doing the mitzvahs and following the Torah and learning from the Torah, because the whole idea in the Torah is that we're learning from the people who went before us, who went through certain things that didn't work, so we should take a different strategy. And we're learning from that. It's like our parents. We learn from our parents what they went through. We know that's something that doesn't work. We know not to do it. If we take the approach that if I do good and I be good, Hashem will help me in everything I do, that's also like a very passive kind of attitude to take. The most important thing is we have to remember to do the work. The work being not so much to, like an accountant to add up the columns, but to make sure that he does that, in addition to making sure he gets out in time to get home to make a proper Shabbos.
So what's the question?
There has to be some kind of a combination of being...
Yes, of course. A person's working within natural law, and he does everything he's supposed to do. And
right.
How things work out in terms of what he makes for the year, that's in God's hand. But you said you had a question or no?
Yeah, there was a question, because I spoke to somebody, and the person said to me, well, I know that if I daven every day, things are supposed to be working my way. And I said, you know, you just don't sit there and daven. You just don't do the daven.
Of course.
You have to also be active.
Of course.
Between.
That's what we call a no-brainer. Of course,
right.
That's obvious.
Exactly. So this is what I was trying to explain.
Yeah, of course.
No, it's sometimes if they take just one sentence and make it work for them. I'm sorry,
yeah.
I'm taking too much time, but I just wanted to clarify that so I can tell the person.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's the whole point here. They're saying, you know, if you're lazy, you don't fix the house, it's not going to fix itself. And if you want to have, but we understand now in terms of what the verses are. And that's why he brings in about the wine and the bread. Okay. All right, so now, any question? Jim, Carolyn? Clear? Okay, so we see how it flows now. Now he says verse 20. And he says, also in your thoughts, a king you should not curse, and in your bedroom, meaning your private places, do not curse a rich person. For a bird of the heavens will bring the words, the voice, and those who have wings will tell the matter over. So he says, even in your thoughts, don't curse a king, and in your private rooms, in your bedroom, don't curse the rich. So the commentaries say that this is referring to, Ibn Ezra says, even though that the king is like the we just talked about in 16, you know, woe to us to a land whose king is a nar, a youngster, meaning that he acts like a youngster. So Ibn Ezra says on this verse, on 20, that even though that the king is a lad, be careful that you shouldn't curse him, even in your thoughts. And the matter really means in your heart. Even in places where you know, where only you know them, even there, be careful. And even in a private place, you shouldn't curse the rich. Because if a king hears it, he'll hurt you with his power, and the rich person will hurt you with his wealth. I mean, people who have wealth, they have many means of slaying their enemies. So it would appear to be a very good advice. And he says that, you know, the bird of the heaven will bring this, or one who has wings. So word can get out, basically. And you don't want to put yourself in any type of damage, any type of risk. But why is this verse here? See, Ibn Ezra makes it clear. He says because a person who has a king, well, I don't think it'll apply in our situation here because there's so many, you know, hundreds of millions of people in the United States, so you're not going to get selected out. And everybody trashes the government personnel anyway. But you're talking here where it's more of a local, like a town somewhere, you know, there's maybe a thousand families, a few thousand families, and in cases like that, people do occasionally rub shoulders with the mayor. And then you can be identified easily. And then if you say something, you can get back to him, and that could really be very damaging to yourself. So if that's the situation, and that's the scenario where it was talking earlier, so then be very careful not to vent your frustration with those rulers that are doing a lousy job, because that's just going to come back to you. And if you really care about your affairs, and that's why you're upset with who is running, so keep that in mind. Keep it in mind that you really have a concern about how affairs are going for you because of the bad mayor. Well, won't affairs be even worse if you say something and it gets back to them? Okay, and Nachshon, let me know if I answered your question. I see what you're asking on screen. Okay, so I don't think that applies in our situation here, with a person talking about the president or things of that nature. But if it's, again, like it's more closely knit community and it's a smaller group we're talking about, like your local mayor or your legislator, whatever, that's where this can apply. So that's why it comes in after this, because this is now following through on the discourse that King Solomon is giving on good rulers versus poor rulers. But you see that he's addressing something, that a person will have an aggressiveness towards the politicians. But why is it that a person might curse the rich? That would answer politics. Hello?
Yeah. Rabbi, is it because they're jealous that they're not rich?
I was thinking that too, yes. I was thinking that because if the person that is addressing here all along are these lazy kings or lazy rulers, and then he brings it to you, if you have a house, don't be lazy, don't let the roof sag. If that's really what's the underlying motivation, so then what's going to happen is you might express it towards the people who have the money. You could have it too if you worked, he's saying. But if you don't, so then it may come out, and it's trying to, I think you're right, that it may come out that this type of a frustration, and a person will naturally, mock the people that have the money because it's intolerable to his mind that other people have what he really wants. But the bottom line is, if he worked diligently, he can get there, because these people didn't get rich overnight. And typically a person has money because they were really... they put the nose to the grindstone. They worked, they labored, they sweated, they put hours in, and they were honest about their work. And because again, people are not honest. You see, like, the Ponzi schemes, like Madoff, things like that. You can get rich there too, but it usually comes out later on, especially if you have other people that you're working with. So, sometimes it leaks. People's conscience can't take it. That if you're doing something crooked, somehow it's going to get out. Or the person himself sometimes is still guilt-ridden about the crooked life that he's leading, that he will unconsciously or consciously even say something. He'll leak it out somehow in order that he should get punished. He feels so guilty that he wants somebody to punish him. So that's a phenomenon too. So here, it could very well be that that type of personality that leads to a house that's broken down is the type of personality that will have the propensity to curse the rich because of jealousy. All right, and he says, not even in your thoughts. And that's why you see the verse starts with the word also. 20 starts with the word also because it's a continuation. It shows you how it's part of the theme. Also in your thoughts, you shouldn't curse the king. I mean, it should be something which is so distant from you. Because even if something's in your thoughts, nobody's going to know about it. But evidently, King Solomon is telling you that that could be where the problem emerges. And if it's something which you entertain in your mind, so that's only a step away from speech. So he's telling you, do not even give into it in your thoughts. All right, and because we understand that once a person's energies goes into an area, they can start swelling and they can grow more. So you stop it, you nip it at the bud, as they say.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Why does it say the reason is because the bird of the sky is going to carry the sound?
Well, the Sforno gives a funny thing. He says that because of the way the wind blows, the sound can be brought. I think it's simply that that people can hear it. Once you give voice to something, you don't know who's around.
If you're just thinking it.
Well, that's what he says also by the rich. He says that in terms of the rich, that you shouldn't curse the rich. That's in voice. It's only in thought when he's talking about the king. If you read the verse, he says, also in your thoughts, a king you should not curse. And in your bedrooms, you shouldn't curse the rich. So there in the bedroom, that means that he doesn't say thoughts anymore.
Okay.
And that's what Ibn Ezra says. He says it's a mashal. It's a metaphor for those people who heard what you just said. Yeah, it has to give air. Okay, and Nachshon, you're asking, how does this apply to religious leaders and incorrect teachings? I don't see the equation. You want to elaborate, Nachshon? Nachshon actually is joining us on the internet. So I'm just looking at it, what he typed in. And he's saying that because the rabbis are considered rich in Torah knowledge. No, we're talking about rich people. We're just literally wealthy people. Certainly a person shouldn't curse his teachers that are knowledgeable. That's the Torah tells you, open, that's a, one of the 613 commands is not to curse a prince, to curse one of the leaders of the Jews. It applies to parents too. But here is, we're not talking about either one. Now we're just talking about venting your aggression towards somebody who's wealthy. Don't do it. That person has a lot of means. That person has to be very careful when he's, the truth is, the person should talk very little, only talk when necessary. Certainly, you shouldn't be talking negative about people, and certainly about people that can hurt him. That's foolish. That's a funny thing. I see this, that I see people, and we just went through Yom Kippur, and we were atone for our sins, then like a week later, I hear people that are, they're really engaged in learning. And it's funny, and they're just sitting around a table speaking Lashon Hara. It was amazing, with this really just downgrading people. And one guy was even doing it about his own father. So it seems to be certain people that they could be dichotomized in their mind. They really are into intelligence and learning and seeing ideas. But it's not applying. They're not applying it to their emotional life. Their emotional life is still, very much engaged in evil speech, and even about their father. It's like a, it's a very, very difficult. But this is, this happens. This happens. You can have a dichotomy. A person really doesn't apply the perfections of Torah to his life. So then it's really, things are awry. Things are going to go awry. That's the Torah is really to be understood and to see how, you know, I guess a person won't really, a person does that, doesn't really see the damaging effects of it. Okay, and Nachshon is asking, so there's no problem expressing a disagreement with a policy or a teaching, not cursing? No. If a person wants to disagree with a policy or a teaching, you, of course a person has a right to disagree. That's the whole Talmud is full of disagreements. A person seeking the truth, it has to occur that he's going to have disagreements with other people. But there's a right way to do it. So if a person wants to disagree with the king and he wants to disagree with a rich person, he should do it in a good, respectful manner, just like any other person. We're talking about cursing, though. That's where you're just degrading a person. There's no constructive question. There's no constructive advice. It's really a personal attack. Character assassination. There is no purpose whatsoever, and it can only hurt you, and it can hurt you very much. And sometimes when you disagree and you give a good argument for your disagreement, the person will appreciate that. That's what King Solomon says also. He says if you rebuke a fool, he'll hate you. But if you rebuke a wise person, he'll love you. Because he wants to know if he's making a mistake. And some leaders take it personal. So yeah, that you have to assess. You have to assess when your critique is going to be falling on deaf ears, or when it really could be constructive. If it's really not going to help, so then there's no use. It could only hurt you. So you have to really assess the situation. Okay, Nachshon. Okay. So King Solomon again is saying here that in thoughts and in speech, both areas, a person should control himself, and both of these parties, people in politics and people who have wealth. Okay, that's pretty much what I had prepared for today. Any questions or comments before we wrap it up today?
No, I'm good. Bye-bye.
Okay. Jim, everything clear, Jim? Rivka? Daryl?
Okay, thank you, Rabbi.
I'm pretty clear.
No, we're doing okay.
All good points made.
Okay. Right, it's very practical. I think these ideas are very clear. And it really follows through with what we were studying up to this point. And sometimes points are more abstract, and they take a little more digging here. I think, you know, as the commentaries bear it out, that it's very, he's giving, you know, very sound advice. All right, so what we'll do is, we're going to start the next week. We will start with Chapter 11. And you can look through the first couple of verses. All right, and we'll pick up next week same time, right?
Okay, great.
Okay. Thanks, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Okay, my pleasure. All right, Nachshon, glad you joined. I'm glad to hope you join us next week. We'll do 11:15 every Sunday. Everybody else have a good week.
Yes, you too.
Okay, and we'll continue going. Okay. Right now, Nachshon, we've been doing Koheles. We've been doing this for the past couple of years. So we're going to finish up, I guess, hopefully this year. We just have, I think, two chapters left. And to join on the phone, I'll type it on screen for you. Let's see where I got it. Okay, there's the number 28936. Okay, right. All right, so that's the access code. That's the phone number. I think it's a toll-free. I think. I'm not sure. And 11:15 every Sunday. All right? All right, so have a good week now, Sean.
Okay.